Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, Senator Chris Dodd unveiled his plan to rewrite American financial regulation. It will help prevent another crisis, he says, and restore faith in the nation's economy. But the legislation has already been through a thicket of compromises and will no doubt face more. Will it be enough to get American finance, the American economy, on the straight and narrow, on a firmer foundation? Enough to forestall another ugly crash? We'll take a look. This hour, On Point, Big Money and the next step in regulating Wall Street. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Is this it? The answer to the shenanigans that nearly brought down the U.S. economy. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York is Robin Farzad, senior writer for Business Week magazine. Robin, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good. So what does this look like, and how does it compare to what the House has already done, Robin?
This really looks like a bit of a leftward lurch in terms of the Senate version. You're giving all of these miscellaneous powers, things that were in question, to the Federal Reserve. And that's in large part to a good amount of lobbying from the Treasury and maybe some moral suasion from the Fed. So if in doubt, the power does go to the Fed.
Now, why does that constitute a leftward lurch? I think some on the left don't want to see the Fed with more power. They say, look, they failed last time.
There are some that say that, but broadly speaking, maybe almost in neoclassical terms, this is a consolidation, almost strong central financial government. And Republicans, I think, are increasingly chafing at this notion because you have an increasing pungency of the Tea Party people and those that are saying that, yes, investment bankers are evil, yada, 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 but we can't just make this an excuse to give a blank check to Washington, which has already increased its balance sheet by trillions.
Blank check to Washington. I mean, that's kind of funny, given that it was Wall Street that melted down. But take us through some of the elements here. What are the biggest ones, Robin?
Well, $50 billion is the headline number. The Dodd bill is going to allow the Fed to scrutinize any bank holding company with more than $50 billion in assets.
Mm-hmm.
And large companies that aren't even banks could be brought into that bucket as well. And that's, you know, a threshold that a lot of people originally thought would be quite higher, $100 billion. So this does bring a lot of people into that regulatory net. And there's another element that's controversial that brings under the Fed's auspices consumer financial protection arm, where you can regulate what credit cards and mortgage originators can do. And that's an independent unit within the central bank. And it's going to be given a good dollop or two of power and autonomy. And
Elizabeth Warren had fought for that to be an independent consumer protection agency, but it is not.
It will have independence within the Federal Reserve.
I see.
So the Federal Reserve does seem to give it prestige and muscle.
Mm-hmm. Systemic risk. Everybody talks about it and is worried about it. How does this package address it?
It does put in place some version of the Volcker Rule, which the former Fed chair, Paul Volcker, said that we have to have restrictions on bigger banks using their own capital. And it does put in at least a framework in place for a controlled demolition of some of these large institutions.
If they start to fail, a way to wrap them up or close a bank with government intervention, but not bailout.
Yes, Tom, and it's what it's being called to kind of pro forma as a systemic risk council. Again, this is all in theory. We've never seen it done in practice, but at least something that approaches the addressing of the too big to fail problem, these guys would argue, is a start.
There was a lot of hand-wringing about the very exotic, complicated financial instruments that everybody lost track of, got AIG and others in trouble. How does it address that, Robin?
There are hedge funds that are going to be increasingly regulated within this. The bill is going to require those that have more than $100 million under assets to register with the SEC and increasingly disclose financial data. But what's an open question is the formation of what a lot of people were arguing for was a central clearinghouse for derivatives. Derivatives are still a great unknown in this business. There might be $400 to $500 trillion of derivative values out there, and it's essentially whatever these banks want to create. It's whatever their minds want to conjure up. So whatever happens in reconciliation between the House and Senate versions, you're going to see people, there's going to be a tug of war, people calling for More regulation, the Elizabeth Warren types and those that are approaching more the Tea Party mentality as November approaches and are saying less regulation. But the devil is going to definitely be in the details.
And executive compensation, corporate governance, shareholders get a say on pay and corporate affairs here, but it's not binding. How does that change?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's a pretty unwieldy process. If you're a shareholder of one of these banks, say Citibank or Goldman Sachs, you can withhold votes. You can push your mutual fund that owns a chunk of these companies to withhold votes, but there isn't a very direct lever that you could pull. And this does make it a little more direct in saying that there's something for a say or pay vote. It can be up and down at the shareholder meeting, but the problem is it's non-binding. It's, again, something that the company would have to take into consideration. So it seems to be a watered-down compromise between what the most ardent of shareholder rights activists argue for and what, obviously, the very significant financial lobby is pressing for.
Now, as you say, they would have to reconcile with the House bill, Barney Frank, and all that, but what about just getting out of committee and getting through the Senate? First, do they have the votes? The Democrats, I guess, because Republicans are sitting on their hands, they're not going to vote for it, I understand. Can they get it out without them?
It's an open question. Bob Corker, who's the senator from Tennessee, who was
Republican,
a Republican, Mr. Dodd's negotiating partner on this, has already cast a few soft aspersions on it. He says that the Treasury really is pushing too left on this, and the Republicans are definitely going to want to have their say, their imprimatur on the bill. And you can imagine they're emboldened with what just happened in Massachusetts. Do they definitely want to hand all this over when they feel potentially victory and traction around the corner?
And if it comes to the Senate floor, they'd need, as I understand, all the Democrats and one Republican, once again, to avoid a filibuster. What's it look like? Do you know?
That's right. I mean, you wonder if they can pick off one of these Northeastern Republicans who, the ones that always seem to be the swing voters on issues like this. There's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure. The Obama administration pushed for this to come out to the fore, for Dodd to not be coy on these measures, because they... the Democrats sense that they do have political capital behind this, the punish the bankers element, the re-regulation thing, the anger that's still out there with double-digit employment as you see Wall Street getting its groove back and profits being outsized and in compensation once again. So it depends on how the Democrats ultimately cast this as an us versus them, as a, you know, you're voting against Main Street if you turn down this Dodd package. Let's see what happens.
Robin Farzad at Businessweek. It's always great to talk with you. Thanks for being with us, Robin.
Pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Here's Connecticut Senator, Democrat Chris Dodd, yesterday chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, saying that strong action is required to fix America's financial regulation system.
The legislation I'm offering today is comprehensive in its scope because the crisis it aims to solve is comprehensive in its scope, not to mention the tragedy of its consequences. We must restore confidence and optimism in our economy, accountability in our markets, and stability to our middle class.
Senator Chris Dodd, yesterday we're looking this hour at Dodd's package of proposed financial regulation and whether it will do the necessary on Wall Street. Joining us now from Washington is Simon Johnson, professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. He's also co-founder, blogger at the website BaselineScenario.com. His new book, 13 Bankers, The Wall Street Takeover and the Next Financial Meltdown, written with James Kwok, comes out March 30th. Simon Johnson, welcome back.
Hi, Tom.
And from Washington, we're joined by Douglas Elliott, former investment banker at J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, now a fellow in economic studies and the Initiative on Business and Public Policy at the Brookings Institution. Doug Elliott, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Doug, first to you. You've been on the street. You see what's coming out of the Senate. It's still got to be reconciled. There's a whole lot of action. But do you see a regulatory answer, commensurate with the crisis we've just come through? Is this it, Doug?
Look, I'm pretty optimistic among the people you'll be talking to. I think this gets us probably two-thirds of the way to where we need to be, which, considering how bad things were and how difficult it is to get anything done in our system, is not a bad result.
Does two-thirds mean that if and when this passes, Americans can breathe easier about the kind of thing they saw 18 months ago? That are we really, you know, in a different universe from that? Or even with this, can we slide right back to it?
Nothing we do is going to eliminate the possibility of another severe financial crisis at some point. The best we can do is reduce the chance of it happening, push it out farther, make it less bad when it happens.
Simon Johnson, what do you see in Chris Dodd's package? Has he stepped up to the challenger?
No, he hasn't. I think it's profoundly disappointing. It's not entirely his fault. It's also due to the fact the administration proposed quite weak legislation back last summer. The House didn't make a great deal of progress, and the Senate has basically run into various brick walls. But there's almost nothing here that will address the essential problem, which is that we've built large banks that are too big to fail and well on their way to becoming too big to save.
Senator Dodd says, right in his own summary of the bill, ends too big to fail. He's, you know, we've done it. Ends the possibility that taxpayers will be asked to write a check to bail out financial firms that threaten the economy.
Well, sadly, just repeating that slogan over and over again doesn't do anything. Ask yourself this, Tom: what is there in this bill that Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan Chase or any of the big banks would be upset about? What is there left from even the original weak proposals that would put pressure on them, that would constrain their size, that would limit the kinds of risks that they can take as we go into the next credit cycle? And I think the answer is very, very little.
Does upsetting Goldman Sachs, is that the bar for what constitutes success?
No, not necessarily, although I think under current circumstances it would be an indicator. I mean, if the big banks, Tom, are completely happy with what you propose after a major financial crisis in which they all more or less failed and had to be rescued at vast cost to the taxpayer and with 8 million jobs lost, if at the end of the day you propose things that the banks say, oh yeah, fine, no problem at all, does that tell you, do you have a good feeling about that or not?
Doug Elliott, are the big banks going to be, are they perfectly happy with what they see in this package?
No, they aren't at all. There's a lot of things, mostly details, that are not going to be of great interest to your listeners, probably, which they don't like. There will also, something that they largely support but is not any fun for them, is going to be significantly higher capital requirements and liquidity requirements. That is, banks are going to have to be holding significantly more capital as a margin for error. It's what they have to protect themselves against mistakes and bad luck.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Senator Chris Dodd's new regulations for Wall Street and the finance industry proposed, and whether they are tough enough to do the job. Simon Johnson is with us, former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund. His new book, 13 Bankers, comes out the end of this month. Douglas Elliott, former investment banker at J.P. Morgan Chase, is here joining us from the Brookings Institution in Washington. Here's Senator Chris Dodd again yesterday saying a primary goal is to end government bailouts like we've just seen.
First, the legislation will end too big to fail bailouts. Never again should the American taxpayer be asked to write a check because of an implicit guarantee that the federal government will bail out a company when it collapses would threaten the stability of the economy as a whole. Companies simply shouldn't be that big or that complex. It isn't safe for our nation. And we will discourage that through the new capital requirements and other strong supervisory protections.
Senator Dodd, never again on the bailouts, he says. Here's Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee saying late last week that he and Senator Dodd had talked about it, that he'd warned Dodd to slow down, said he saw Dodd's new draft bill as a tactic.
I think that what Chairman Dodd is going to do probably is introduce a bill on Monday that's a little to the left of where we were, okay, to try to ensure that he can get as much as he can in the way of Democratic support in the committee. And then hopefully what he will do is move to the right. For me, I think a better course of action would have been to try to introduce something that's in the middle of the road.
Simon Johnson, Doug Elliott, I want to talk about this left-right framing of the thing in a second. But first, Simon, if I can come to you, you heard Senator Dodd there saying it will end too big to fail bailouts. I think you're already saying no, it won't. What's the gap in his understanding and yours there, do you think?
I think that the fact of the matter is, Tom, that these large banks, our largest, say, six banks, were big before the crisis. They had assets to GDP around 58%. That's up a lot from the early 1990s when the same banks were less than 20% of GDP. But as a result of the collapse and the bailout and the rescue and all the forbearance and advantages they've received since the crisis. These banks have actually got bigger. They're now over 63% of GDP. That's total bank assets compared to the size of our economy. So in other words, the biggest banks have gotten bigger because of what happened. And there is nothing in this legislation that would prevent that from continuing. They have massive advantages. They have big funding advantages. It's easy for them to raise capital. They have a lot of market share in key dark markets around over-the-counter derivatives, for example. These guys are going to make a lot of money. They're going to get even bigger until the next time when there'll be a much tougher problem that'll emerge out of the failure of one or more of them.
Doug Elliott, do you see a break on too big to fail here, or a break with the past that was that meant bailouts for too big to fail, or not?
Not really. I mean, I agree with Simon on that part of it. I unfortunately think we're basically stuck with too big to fail banks because I think they do have an economic role, and that's an area where Simon and I disagree. I think there are actually economic reasons that they're as big as they are. But I don't think that a politician just constantly saying we're ending too big to fail means it's true. I agree. There's nothing in here that will keep it from happening. There are things that should reduce the probability. There are things that should make it safer and less expensive. But no, I think we're still in danger.
But that was just about as much as we could swallow last time, never mind morally, just fiscally. I mean, if it comes again, what does the country do?
Well, first of all, it wasn't actually as much as we could swallow. We're going to end up maybe $100 billion down from, in terms of just the straight fiscal cost, that is, the direct cost of the taxpayer, ignoring the fact that the recession obviously cost everybody a lot of money, including the taxpayers. Direct fiscal cost, it actually was not immensely expensive for the size of our economy, but the things that are being put in place should reduce that cost. It's just not going to eliminate the risk that this might happen.
Simon, it's just an occasional, hit we have to take, it sounds like, in Doug's interpretation.
Well, I think we have to push back quite strongly on that notion. This is also a point that Secretary Geithner has been making in these various articles that have been coming out, sort of profiling him in this situation. Yes. I mean, and he also makes the same point that the direct cost has not been very large. But that's not what you should focus on here. You should focus on, you should look at what the Congressional Budget Office looks at, for example. What is the increase in net government debt held by the private sector relative to the baseline, i.e. what would have happened otherwise? And my estimate, this is my personal estimate, but the CBO is moving in this direction, and I've checked this with people on Capitol Hill as recently as yesterday. My estimate is we will have an increase in government debt around 40 percentage points, 40 percentage points of GDP. That's roughly speaking a doubling of our government debt. For what? So that some guys on Wall Street could take enormous risks. They could ruin their banks. They could destroy millions of lives and opportunities. We double our government debt. That's ridiculous, Tom. That's outrageous. That is a huge cost. It must not happen again.
Douglas Elliott, what do you say to that view, that bottom line?
Well, first of all, I mean, I agree with what Simon is saying. We want to avoid this sort of financial crisis as best we possibly can. It's tremendously expensive. It's just too big to fail was only a relatively small part of what created this. Remember, we had a massive bubble in housing, in commercial real estate, in a lot of other places. It's the bursting of that bubble which is so incredibly painful. And everybody virtually in the markets was participating in that. Small banks, for example, though they're being portrayed as saints, they participated in a massive commercial real estate bubble that is going to destroy a lot of them. If we'd managed to avoid too big to fail and had, say, twice as many of the large banks but not as big, they would have still all been making the same play on housing. So there are plenty of things we have to fix. I'm just saying too big to fail is just a piece of it.
I want to get to our callers, but Simon, how about that? It wasn't a lack of oversight. It was a bubble. Everybody was in on it.
Well, I think it's a system of incentives, Tom. And the incentives are very simple. You take a lot of risk. You persuade the regulators that what you're doing is okay. There's been a lot of ideological capture, I would say, of Washington by Wall Street, as well as an enormous amount of campaign contributions spread around. So over 20 years, maybe slightly more, there was a systematic relaxation of all the rules around finance. We had a pretty well-run and tightly regulated financial system from the mid-1930s until somewhere in the mid-70s, a little bit into the 1980s. All of those constraints and sensible restraints were removed, and out of that came big problems. Now, too big to fail was part of that, an important part of that, going into the crisis. But I think we're talking about the next crisis, Tom. We're talking about the next meltdown now, and these big banks have become bigger. Their incentives to take reckless risks and to get out of control are even stronger, and they've learned that if they do that, if they fail, they will be rescued. They get to keep their jobs, their pensions, everything about their empires, and they can even get bigger. That's an incentive to do it again.
I understand. Would this package get us back to that 1970s status on regulation, or close, or not near?
No, this package is basically a smokescreen and window dressing.
Let's go to our callers, Omaha, Nebraska, Sandy. Sandy, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call, sure. And I appreciate the opportunity to be on with such august guest as well.
Yes, sir.
I guess I would like to hear some further discussion of the point Simon just made regarding the ideological capture of Washington. My background, personally, I went to the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business, spent a little time on Wall Street myself,
mm-hmm.
And as I look at this, a key aspect of that capture of Washington is the intellectual framework that was put forth of efficient market theory that claimed that the market will take care of itself, will get all these economic efficiencies, that it's worth taking all this risk because everybody will, rational market participants won't take on this risk.
Right.
I just think that, it does. You can repeal Glass-Steagall, but you can't repeal human nature. And I think that whole efficient markets theory has a lot to do with it.
It's a great point and question, Sandy. Thanks for it. Doug, let me come to you with that. I mean, it's interesting. Even at the top of the hour, we talked with Robin Farzad at Business Week, the reporter or writer. Even he's putting this in left-right terms, more left. But Simon's saying, this package would not even take us back to the kind of regulation we had in the 1970s when this was hardly a leftist nation. What about intellectual capture and the center of gravity now and efficient markets theory? You hear Sandy's skepticism.
Sure. And by the way, let me be clear. I'm not saying there weren't regulatory faults. Mm-hmm. Virtually every institution out there on Wall Street, the rating agencies, the regulators, the politicians in Congress, even individuals, if you take them as a group, made mistakes. But I think what a lot of people underplay is a point that follows on Sandy's, which is, unfortunately, our markets and our institutions are made up of humans. Humans have a tendency to overreact by becoming too optimistic, other times being too pessimistic, or getting caught up in some fad. I think an underlying reason why so many people made so many mistakes is we'd had 25 basically very good years in the financial markets from when the Dow bottomed out, mm-hmm. in 1982 at about 800.
Right.
It went up by a factor of almost 20. It seemed like people were handing you money to take risks. And unfortunately, so many people became lax about the risks, and that included the politicians and the ideologues that were described.
But the efficient markets theory was part of the rationale for letting the restraints go, as everybody slipped into the hot tub. So what about now? We saw what happened at the end of that. It wasn't pretty. Should we be, rolling back the ideological perspective here to something that worked, as Simon says, for decades after the Great Depression?
Well, I think we should move forward in terms of the intellectual perspective. That is, we've learned a lot. One of the things we've learned is that the efficient markets theories are riddled with flaws because markets are run by humans. We've more and more had a recognition by economists and people in finance that there are human mistakes that play out on a large scale, and we're starting to learn how to understand those better.
Simon, do you think we're getting a grip on our core assumptions here? You hear Sandy, he went to Chicago, so he knows efficient market theory, the B school anyway, and he wants it tightened up here.
Well, Sandy made some very good points, but this is not left versus right, Tom, to go back to your other question. I would appeal to a different part of the Chicago tradition, one most closely associated with George Stigler, who also got a Nobel Prize for this work, mm-hmm. and that's about regulatory capture. And Stigler and his adherents take the view very strongly that industries tend to persuade their regulators that whatever the industry wants to do is good. I mean, you can look at Enron, for example, mm-hmm. in the 1990s, is a spectacular example of that. And I think that what the financial industry has done over the past 20 or 30 years is convince the regulators and the legislature and pretty much everyone in government, actually, that finance is good, unregulated finance is better, and massive unregulated financial markets and financial firms are the best. This is a mistake. This is a fundamental error, and it is the most extraordinary example of state capture, actually, but bigger than regulatory capture. This is state capture. I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in the modern United States.
Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa, and Tony. Tony, you're on the air.
Yes, gentlemen. Let's talk some more about these OTC derivatives, over-the-counter, meaning that the details are known only to those who enter into the contract. And we add
right.
to that leverage, and we really have no idea of the scale of what we're dealing with. I mean, that's the insidious thing about these instruments.
That no one's tracking them. There's no record.
We have a federal agency that was federally mandated to regulate these instruments and to investigate fraud. It is the Commodities Futures Trade Commission. This agency was stripped of its regulatory oversight in the late 1990s, after which then-chairwoman Brooksley Bourne mm-hmm. resigned under protest.
Right.
Now, I have heard proposals, notably by a former finance House Chair Jim Leach, to combine the Commodities Futures Trade Commission with the SEC. Now, do you believe this would restore some regulatory oversight into derivatives? Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. Simon, what do you say?
I don't think we've ever had regulatory oversight over the over-the-counter derivatives. So it's not wouldn't restore. It's a question of really creating it for the first time. And Brooksley Bourne was right. Brooksley Bourne in 1998 said that we should regulate these markets, and she was turned down by other powerful people in the Clinton administration, some of whom are now back in government. That was a very unfortunate mistake, and it should be addressed. I, for one, would absolutely support creating one integrated regulator that would deal with all derivative-related issues. How you would arrange that, we could discuss, but you need a strong regulator for OTC derivatives, and these derivatives have to be treated much more like other derivatives, like futures, that are traded through exchanges and have for a long time been tightly regulated.
Doug Elliott, Senator Dodd says, you know, he's bringing transparency and accountability for exotic instruments that would include derivatives. What is the mechanism being proposed here, and do you think it'll be effective in getting a little more handle on this?
Well, first, I pretty much agree with Simon on this one. I will say the administration, the House version and the Senate version, all move largely in the same direction, which is to try to push standardized derivatives onto exchanges where there'd be a lot more transparency,
mm-hmm.
ones that aren't quite standardized enough for exchanges but can be done through so-called clearinghouses would be done that way, which is still a step forward. And any remaining over-the-counter derivatives, which there probably would be quite a lot, would have significantly higher capital requirements, which should make them significantly safer, and there'd be a lot more information reported. Now, you can argue about exactly the right way to do these things, but we will be making a big step in the right direction.
What do you think about the left-right framing of the debate over what should be done here? Is that the right way to look at it? Is it a realistic way? Is it just a left-right politics or something more akin to housekeeping here, Doug?
Oh, some of these things are more housekeeping because we figured out what didn't work and we're trying to do better. Some of the issues are left-right. Some of them, it's really hard to say ideologically how they fall out. I mean, one that clearly is left-right and where the Senate bill moves to the right is the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, because there it's pretty clear that liberals want there to be a new independent agency with a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
Conservatives would prefer there was no new agency, and if there has to be one, they'd rather it's weak and part of some larger organization.
Simon, we just got half a minute before the break here, but is there a conservative reason for consumers not to have protections after what we've seen in terms of how they've been twisted around?
No, absolutely not. If you want free and fair markets, Tom, you have to have people behaving in a decent manner. This is an industry that has bragged on the record about ripping the faces off customers. People talk about rebuilding confidence, and I talk to a lot of business people about this. I work with a lot of entrepreneurs. I'm a professor of entrepreneurship at MIT. They don't want the financial sector to be able to do this to their customers. It's not helpful to the U.S. economy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Senator Chris Dodd's new regulations for Wall Street and the finance industry and whether they're tough enough to do the job. Simon Johnson is here, co-author of the new book out the end of this month, 13 Bankers, professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Douglas Elliott is with us, former investment banker with J.P. Morgan Chase. He's now at the Brookings Institution. Let's hear a little more from Washington. This is not Chris Dodd, but a fellow Democrat from Delaware. Senator Ted Kaufman, in a speech on the floor of the Senate last week, cautioning against reform measures that aren't strong enough to affect real change.
The burden of proof should be upon those who would only tinker at the edges of our current system of financial regulation. After a crisis of this magnitude, it amazes me that some of the reform proposals effectively maintain the status quo in so many critical areas, whether it's allowing multi-trillion-dollar financial conglomerates that house both traditional banking and speculative activities to continue to determine their own capital standards, are permitting a significant portion of the derivatives market to remain opaque and lightly regulated.
Well, there's Senator Kaufman, but again, Senator Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee, said it's all about being vigilant. The federal agencies, everything, just need to be more vigilant.
Everything else to me is just moving deck chairs around to act like you've done something. What we need to do is make sure the regulatory agencies that are in place do the things they're supposed to do, okay? And so, you know, I think I probably shouldn't be saying this. I think it's all been kind of silly. I think at the end of the day, personally, this is my prediction, nothing changes much. Okay? But let me say this. A lot will change. A lot will change as it relates to the standards these entities are held to.
Senator Bob Corker, nothing changes much. A lot will change. I'm not sure where that leaves us. Simon, we've got a lot of feedback here. From Facebook is Savannah Espinoza. She says, I do not trust that government will get tough enough on the financial industry. Government is too entwined with the financial industry. And Al, in a web comment, reminds us of kind of the what all this has cost. He says, it's like what happened didn't happen to one of your guests. He says, hello. Maybe he's tweaking you there, Doug. What about people who have to leave retirement? What about the people who can't retire because they've lost their life savings? These are things you work for all your life. Financial institutions can recover, but individuals have one life. Al, there's a lot of outrage out there in the country about what happened and the lack of regulation that permitted it. Doug.
Yeah, look, let me be very clear. I didn't say this wasn't an immensely important thing.
Yep.
I was talking about whether certain aspects of this were created by too big to fail.
Mm-hmm.
This financial crisis was an immensely bad thing. Many people and institutions made mistakes that led up to it, and we should certainly examine those as we have been. So let me just make clear, I didn't suggest, actually, Tom, I think you had put some words in my mouth.
Forgive me.
To the effect of this is just something that happens from time to time. That is not my view.
But if you say economically we need banks that are too big to fail.
We need, I believe, and this is a difficult thing to prove in either direction, that we do need in this country a small number of banks that are truly global in scale, have a very wide range of products, and that have significant size in each of those products to be efficient. I do think that contributes economically. It unfortunately means that when you add that all up, they're bigger than our politicians and bureaucrats will allow to fail if we hit a serious financial crisis.
Right.
I wish I had a great answer to that. The best I can see is, as the administration has been proposing, is to try to do a bunch of things to make them safer. Higher capital requirements, more liquidity requirements, all the systemic things we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Simon, how about it? If that's the world we live in, it's globalized and you've got to have some mega players out there, how do you square that with the desire not to have more bailouts, not to have more meltdowns, you know, at least as few as there can possibly be in this economy of ours?
Well, I really disagree that we need to have these banks at this scale, that they serve any economic function. I spend a lot of time talking to business, Tom. That's part of what I do at MIT and in other contexts. And I talk to CFOs. I talk to other people who work with the financial sector. They don't find the case for these mega banks to be compelling. I've looked very carefully through the economic and finance literature. No one can show you any economies of scale in banking over $100 billion in total assets. Goldman Sachs was a well-run bank in the mid-1990s. Its size was about $200 billion, $270 billion in today's dollars. It peaked at $1.1 trillion right before the crisis. No one can show you that there was any benefit to society of them increasing four or five times. Yet we know that the costs and the potential costs are much higher. Goldman, of course, was saved by being allowed to be converted into a bank holding company, you know, at the critical moment in September 2008. So we got all these costs and potential costs. And we don't get any benefits from a social point of view. So there is, as far as I can see, no case for not putting a hard size cap on these banks, for example, as a percent of GDP. Push them all back to where they were in the early 1990s when our financial system worked just fine.
Of course, that's not even on the table. Rosalie, Easton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Rosalie.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What I want to know is, as you said, in the 90s, things were fine. We had regulation. Why don't we bring them all back, all the regulation back, including the Glass-Steagall Act? Why don't they do that?
Why can't it be what it was? Doug, what do you say to that? Simple kind of, let's roll it back.
The world is very different now. We're talking about almost 20 years later. A lot of changes have occurred. Even if you put Glass-Steagall in place, it wouldn't actually solve most of the problems that we're concerned about now. It would create certain other problems. So, for instance, the proprietary trading that so many people have focused on.
That is when they trade with their own funds and take their own risk while they're doing their banking for you.
Yeah, that was perfectly legal for banks to do under Glass-Steagall. So it's easy to say, let's go back to that regulatory structure. I'm sure there are aspects of it that would have helped if we had kept it, but I agree more with Simon's larger point that it's the way in which we used the system and enforced the rules that was unfortunately blunted by an ideological view that free markets were the way to go. The larger regulatory structure, I don't think, was the main reason we had those problems.
Simon, how about it? If maybe we've learned a lesson, and so there'll be a more vigilant attitude, and off we go.
Well, I listened, Tom, on these issues very, very carefully to Paul Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, and really the most distinguished economic policymaker who is still active. And what he has proposed, as you know, and what the president took up rather late in January, but he still took it up, are the so-called Volcker rules. And I have some of my disagreements about exactly the way these have been proposed in legislation. But I think the spirit of what Mr. Volcker is asking for is exactly right. The spirit is that you have a financial system that it must continue to operate in order for the economy to function. And therefore, the government will be involved one way or another through deposit insurance and other mechanisms in keeping that working. So there's a form of explicit and implicit government guarantee for part of the financial system. There should be another part of the financial system, and this is where I'm wearing my entrepreneurship hat, I completely agree. This other part should take risk. They should, you know, look for new technologies that no one else believes in, and they should put a lot of money into them. And sometimes this will play out very nicely, and sometimes you'll lose your shirt. Now, the important point that Volcker's making is separate these two. Have a piece, and this is the spirit of Glass-Steagall. You have a piece, let's call it commercial banking, for want of a better word, the payment system, which is secure and cannot collapse and is backed by the government. You have another piece, which is the risk-taking piece. Let's call that venture capital and all that's associated with that. Mm-hmm. And that piece should not be allowed to use the money that's backed by the government. You should not be able to play with house money. You should take risks with your own money, win, lose, or draw. That's your money. This is a free market philosophy that I'm espousing here, Tom. There's nothing left-wing or right-wing about what I'm saying. This is just a sensible way to run a capitalist free market economy.
Let's go to Dan in Norwich, Vermont. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, the Dodd bill is a big charade. I agree with Simon. We have $500 quadrillion in notional value of over-the-counter derivatives and credit default swaps, et cetera. the big players skim profits off the top of these notional values. They spend those profits, which boosts our GDP. The only way our GDP has grown 3 to 4%, 5% over the last 10 to 15 years is because of these exotic products. You get rid of these exotic products, you tank the economy, you create a double-dip recession or a depression, you put all kinds of national security issues at risk. There's no way we're going to ever regulate over-the-counter derivatives, and this whole dance by Christopher Dodd and his folks in Washington is just that, a dance, because they can't regulate these things. If you regulate them truly, you create a new recession or a depression.
So Dan, you say leave them alone, even though we had trouble with them that led us into a crisis.
Oh, no, don't get me wrong. I don't say leave them alone. I say that the people in Washington are sitting around their tables and saying, well, we cannot touch these over-the-counter things because that's what's account. We have 70% of our economy is based upon consumption. Where does that consumption come from? It comes from the bigwigs who make their billions and trillions of dollars and then spend it in the economy. If we cut back on those profits based upon the half a quadrillion in notional on derivatives, we kill the economy because there's no consumption.
You mean it's... Surely our economy doesn't all depend on investment bankers getting a second Ferrari.
Well, not a second Ferrari, but certainly if you look at the people who are profiting off of the work of what's happening in the over-the-counter markets, the hedge funds, et cetera, the people who are profiting up top and the people who are profiting on the second layer, we're talking 100,000, 200,000, a million individuals who are then spending their money in the greater economy. You really regulate over-the-counter derivatives, you create a depression.
Simon, what do you say?
I'm still writing down quadrillion and the number of zeros involved right. there. But seriously, I think it's a very good point that the caller is making. I think that in some ways, actually, the political economy is worse because there is a so-called end-users coalition, which is companies that benefit from the implicit government subsidy in over-the-counter derivatives. The subsidy is there because most of the broker-dealers are way too big to fail. And that lowers they have this implicit government guarantee that lowers their funding costs. They pass that on to the so-called end-users, who are industrial companies. They lobby very effectively for and have completely succeeded, as far as we can see in the Dodd bill, for an enormous number of exceptions and exemptions from any kind of regulation around derivatives. I disagree with the caller that if we move to on the point that if you move towards regulation that this would cause a Great Depression, there will be a shift of resources away from the financial sector, to be sure. But this is a very flexible economy. We've moved people in and out of the financial sector before, and that would happen again. And I'm not calling for precipitate, immediate, you know, slam the brakes on this or that. You have to phase these things in over 2 or 3 years. But people can move and change jobs and change focus very easily in this economy.
Let's go to John in Beverly, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Great show, as always.
Thanks.
A comment and two questions. My comment is that my understanding is that the banking industry as a whole spends more money on lobbying efforts than all others combined. That's a comment. And how does this relate to what should be wrapped into campaign reform,
right.
Finance reform? The questions I have are, let's reduce this down to a small level. How do things like the fees that are charged with overdrafts, which in effect are in some cases a 5-day loan, and if you calculate the interest on that 5-day loan at a $30 charge or $39 charge in some cases, the interest rate is 10,000%. And in effect, it is a loan, but it's considered a fee. Mm-hmm. And that's the way the banking industry gets around the caps on loans, on interest charges on loans, and considered as a fee. How do things like that sneak through? And is there anything in this bill that relates to what Lehman Brothers did in their accounting scam, where they transferred, you know, toxic assets off their books to make their books look better, and then had those assets transferred back after a period of time? Is there anything in the bill that relates to those issues?
John, let us pick it up. Our time is short, but Douglas Elliott, what about to the last first? Lehman Brothers and the way it kept its books, will that be off limits here under this? Would it be under this regulatory package?
As far as I can tell, that was already off limits. So...
So what is what? But it happened. So either in exercise.
What I mean is, it was probably illegal.
So how do we make sure? Does this somehow tighten things up so it wouldn't happen again?
you can't stop illegal activity. The best you can do is try to catch it. The regulators should perhaps have been able to catch this one. I don't know enough yet about when it started, how long it was done, et cetera.
But, I mean, there are different kinds of policing on the street that may deter crime that could happen if nobody cared. Surely that's the same in policing our finance industry.
We should do a better job. One thing that was touched on earlier that's a tremendous issue is how do you get the regulators to do a better job? And I think it's not just capture by the industry. I think it's difficult to make sure bureaucrats are actually accountable for what they're supposed to be doing. And nobody's shown me a good answer yet, but we'd love to find a way to make the regulators do a better job.
What do you think on the front? This is a smaller, but it amounts to big interest fee, as John saw it, our caller there, about, you know, bank fees and so on.
That's why we need the Consumer Financial Protection Agency to exist and to be independent, because that is exactly the sort of thing that it can tackle.
Do you think it's going to be independent enough, Simon Johnson, that it will be inclined to take on that kind of complaint we heard from our caller, John?
Well, that's the key issue, Tom. We don't know. And that's the one thing in the Dahl proposal that you know, I would say the Consumer Protection Agency is still on life support, is there, but it's on life support, and people are trying to break into the hotel room to yank it off life support, so into the hospital room. So it is really down to the wire on whether the agency will be strong enough. But if I could take on the other point also, on the legality issues in Lehman, Senator Kaufman is giving another speech today. They released the text of it last night. And he's actually insisting that we think much more about the issues, all of the issues we've talked about in the show today, in terms of laws being broken and the breakdown of the rule of law on Wall Street. So in other words, it's not the regulatory tweaking, which you see in the Dodd approach coming through Senate banking, but it's much more issues that should be taken up by the Senate Judiciary Committee, including, for example, this Repo 105, the Lehman hiding of its assets, which is very reminiscent of what Enron did with the assistance of Merrill Lynch. And, of course, some of those Merrill Lynch bankers who were the counterparties on these dubious transactions for Lehman actually went to prison. Is anybody going to be punished for these Lehman transactions? I don't know. I mean, the SEC was there. Lehman people may be claiming, I'm not sure, that the SEC signed off on some of these deals. How could this possibly happen? How could we get exactly an Enron-type situation again, and this time in the heart of our financial system? And what have we done? What are we doing? What are we going to do to prevent that from happening again?
Bring on the prosecutors, you're nearly saying there. Never mind the regulators.
Change the laws and enforce the laws for a change.
Simon Johnson at MIT's Sloan School of Management, his 13 bankers. Wall Street takeover and the next financial meltdown is out at the end of this month, and it's always great to speak with you. Simon, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Douglas Elliott at the Brookings Institution, fellow there in Economic Studies and the Initiative on Business and Public Policy. Doug Elliott, we appreciate your perspective today. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners will be watching as it all rolls through. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.